Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The LA School Board and Teacher Accountability. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. The LA Times plans to release 6,000 evaluations of Los Angeles teachers based on 7 years of student scores on standardized tests in math and English. The Times broke the story on Sunday, but it never spoke to members of the elected school board. Tonight we'll hear from board member Steve Zimmer, a former teacher, who calls the Times plan sinister and says it will break the bond between teachers and parents. We'll also hear from a charter school operator who says school districts should be doing the same thing all by themselves. Later on, weird weather and global warming. First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Last night we heard about the LA Times blockbuster education report, the release of records on 6,000 third through fifth grade elementary teachers in what's called a value-added analysis of their success or failure based on student performance on standardized English and math tests. We heard from Deputy Superintendent John Dacey, who endorsed the process, but only as a part of teacher evaluation. We also heard A.J. Duffy, the president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, call the process a disgrace. He asked union members to boycott the paper. But the Times plans to put all 6,000 names with the records online. And today, President Obama's Education Secretary Arne Duncan said parents have a right to know if their children's teachers are affected. Governor Schwarzenegger's Education Secretary Bonnie Rice said school districts should do the same thing on their own. The Times says those endorsements prove that the issue of teacher accountability is now bipartisan. The elected school board has not been heard from until now. Here is Steve Zimmer, who was endorsed for election by the teachers' union. He himself is a teacher and was one for 17 years. Steve Zimmer, thanks for joining us.
Warren, thank you for talking to me about this.
Were you called in advance of publication by the LA Times?
I wasn't. And let me say, you know, what Secretary Duncan has said and what the governor has said about parents having access to information about a teacher's effectiveness is not wrong in and of itself. What's wrong is the dangerous and reckless way that value-added evaluation is now being elevated to the sole determinant of whether a teacher is effective or not. So essentially what's happening is a child's score on a test now is no longer a high-stakes test. These are astronomical stakes that you couldn't imagine any teacher who wants to keep teaching not teaching to that test. I've never read anything like this in journalism about public education in my entire career.
We heard earlier from Jay Matthews, who's education reporter for the Washington Post, where they in Washington, D.C., they've had issues of a similar kind. He said that he had never heard anything of this kind either. He called it rather daring by the Los Angeles Times. But did the Times say that value-added analysis of these tests would be the only way to determine whether a teacher was succeeding or not? It seemed to me the indication was that it ought to be part of a broader issue, as John Dacey said.
I agree with Dr. Dacey that it should be only one small part of several measures that we're now looking at in our Teacher Effectiveness Task Force that will ultimately determine a school-wide report card on teacher effectiveness and even a teacher's individual effectiveness. Now, the Times may have the caveat that other measures exist, but this is the only measure they're using in this data bank to determine that effectiveness. And the implications of that, if it's allowed to occur, are unprecedented, they're reckless, and they're dangerous.
Ray Cortinas, the current superintendent, was quoted as saying that they've had the data for a long time, but that they have never put it to use and that they probably should have. Jason Felch, the reporter we talked to, said he thought that that was because they had been intimidated by the teachers' union.
No, Ray Cortinas isn't intimidated by anybody, and I don't think that that's the issue. The issue is that Ray Cortinas is an editor, and neither Jason Song or Jason Felch are educators. And educators understand that you have to use multiple measures when you're evaluating student, a teacher, a principal, anybody who's involved in the public education process. So when the superintendent said that we've had this data, he's correct. And we are looking at and we are using that data, but only as one small part of a broader evaluation system. Let me say, Warren, that when we talk about what this will do to public education, what makes a public school a public school is that we serve every child that crosses the schoolhouse gate with equity and without prejudice. If we start looking at children as not what they can learn and not what they can give to a classroom environment, but rather we look at them as their potential test score, that changes the entire scope of how we approach public education. And I don't think that the Times has considered this.
On this question of using the material and being intimidated or not, you said Ray Cortinas wouldn't be intimidated, but what about the members of the school board, yourself included, who are often supported by the teachers' union?
Well, I've said that we need comprehensive evaluation reform. I've also said that we should extend the window for granting tenure from 2 to 4 years. It's not a popular position with teachers. And I believe as part of the evaluation process, there should be a section in that for student and parent surveys. So it's not a question of being intimidated. It's a question of doing it right. And let me say the sinister thing about this article and the Times' entire approach is that they aim directly to rupture the bond between teachers and parents. They give a very clear message in this article that if you are a parent and you trust your teacher, you are naive, you're ignorant, and you're hurting your child. The effects.
You're extrapolating. You're drawing a conclusion of your own when you say that. They didn't say that.
No, they didn't say that. But they were very clear when they highlighted a quote from a parent who says that their teacher, that she is happy with their teacher. And then below that quote, it said, this is a parent of a teacher who is underperforming. And so I might be extrapolating the message, but the implication is clear.
Okay.
And I'm very supportive of parent empowerment and parent engagement as equal partners in the process. But when we intentionally turn parents against their schools and against their teachers, we need to seriously consider the consequences.
Steve Zimmer, board member of the Los Angeles Unified School District since he was elected last year, District 4, Hollywood, West Hollywood, the West Side, and the West Valley, a teacher at Marshall High for 17 years. Mike Piskel is founder and president of ISEF. That's a public school charter organization with 15 schools in the southern part of Los Angeles. And Mike Piskel, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Glad to be here.
What do you think about what the Times did? Was it dangerous, ruthless, and sinister?
No. I think it is long overdue that accountability be brought into the equation. 80% of our kids in the third grade in the city don't read on grade level. 30% don't read at all. We have a 50% dropout rate, and we need to have accountability. I'm a teacher. I taught at one of the most prestigious private schools in LA for 5 years, and I saw firsthand what high expectations can lead our students to. And people said, well, those are the wealthiest kids in the world, and you did a great job with the wealthiest kids in the world. Well, I brought that model to South LA, and I opened up 15 high-performing charter schools, and I proved that those teachers who aren't afraid to challenge their kids can get the same results.
One of the conclusions that the Times drew as a result of the value-added analysis, which was not all directed simply at individual teachers, but they drew some general conclusions as well, and it was that sometimes the best teachers are not necessarily in the wealthy neighborhoods, that in fact the reverse is true, that they're scattered around, sometimes in poor neighborhoods, sometimes in wealthy ones. Were you surprised by that?
No. You have great teachers in low-income communities, and those are the teachers that have high expectations for their kids, that believe in their kids, regardless of their background, regardless of their race, regardless if they have special needs or they're low-income or they're in a foster care home. But you cannot say, well, this child can't do this because, oh my God, look at their situation at home. And there's too many people that are make apologies for that instead of holding that child to a high standard.
How do you evaluate teachers in your system? Do you use the value-added analysis of the math and English test?
Well, yeah, we have for years used it in certain grade levels where it's appropriate. And the third, fourth, and fifth grade is where it's most appropriate. And because you have years of growth and you're teaching reading and you're teaching math, and those are the priorities in third, fourth, and fifth grade. How do you do value-added for chemistry or for physics, where they're only going to have 1 year of chemistry or 1 year of physics? You know, it's interesting the Times didn't do this for the high schools, and it's very difficult to come up with a value-added model in that situation. Okay. So we use the value-added model where we can, and we're getting better at it. We just entered in a partnership with four other charter management organizations called the College Ready Partnership, and it's being funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at $60 million. And value-added model is one of the models we're using, and we're using test scores. But to everybody's point, that Mr. Zimmer made and other folks, only 40% of the evaluation of the teachers is going to be test scores. But it's not going to be a small part. It's going to be 40%.
Okay. All right. Mike Piskel, again, a founder of ICEF, Public Schools Charter Organization, with 15 schools in South Los Angeles. I should add that the Times studied the tests, or had them studied, over 7 years. Joan Herman is director of the National Center for Research on Evaluation Standards and Student Testing at UCLA. She's author of Tracking Your School's Success, A Guide to Sensible School-Based Evaluation. Joan Herman, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Will what the Times is doing, do you think, be a guide to sensible school-based evaluation?
The Times is dealing with a very small slice of either of school performance or teacher performance. I would underscore what Mr. Zimmer said earlier about the limits of using the results of the California Standards Test as the only measure of how well kids are learning. It provides a very narrow slice of academic performance. Certainly, it is the case, as the Times noted so eloquently, that teachers do make a difference, and teachers make a bigger difference than schools make a difference. And I would agree with the other participants that teachers' value-added scores may have a role in teacher evaluation, but only as one source of information and not as the only source of information branding every teacher in the district until some other information magically shows up.
Do you think that what the Times is doing will motivate teachers to be better, as Mike Piskel suggests, or will it rupture the bond between teachers and parents, as Steve Zimmer said?
I think it's going to motivate the district to move more quickly towards their own more balanced teacher evaluation system that includes that is composed of student performance, observations of teachers, analysis of teacher work, as well as potentially parent satisfaction and the like. So I guess I would take a middle ground.
A lot of people say that the observation process, which goes on now, has the impact of allowing everybody to pass effectively, and that poor teachers aren't dealt with in any way, let alone fired. So is this a good thing, then?
Well, I think the observation measures that go on now are pretty feckless, but we are in a position to add rigor to what gets observed and look at classroom practices along with student performance and look at other indicators of student learning that I think are very important.
Mike Piskel just said 40% of the evaluation process might include the value-added testing or analysis, rather, of the math and English tests. Is that too much?
I think that's a political decision, and I would, you know, I'm a methodologist, so I would want to see the data first and look at the reliability of the data. I think that the reliability of data is something that got a little short shrift in the Times article. I note that they started with 7 years of data, more than 600,000 kids, 18,000 teachers, and they end up with a report on 6,000 elementary school teachers. So I don't know what happened to the other 12,000, but that has an impact on their analysis as well. They did use at least 60 kids, but that 60 kids over 7 years, and the folks I run with suggest that you need at least 3 years of data.
Well, they had seven, didn't they?
They had 7 years, apparently, of spotty data. That's different from 3 years of complete data or nearly complete data on every kid.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but very quickly, Steve Zimmer, we're out of time. I just need to ask you, is this a political decision, and does that mean that the board itself will have to address it?
The board will need to address it, and I think that the board's position is to get exactly at those high expectations that Mr. Piskel talked about, is to really have a comprehensive evaluation process in place as soon as possible.
Steve Zimmer, a member of the board of the LA Unified School District, Mike Piskel with ICEF Public Schools, Joan Herman at UCLA. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you, Warren.
Warren Ollie back with Which Way LA. Surveys show that public opinion on climate change quite literally shifts with the weather. When it's hot, concerns increase. When it's not, they decline. Now, there's a more persuasive kind of evidence. The recent spate of extreme weather in many parts of the world appears to confirm predictions made by earlier models of global warming. That's according to the World Meteorological Association. Oliver Morton is Energy and Environment Editor for The Economist magazine, and thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Juan.
You and other reporters are very careful not to make connections between any given weather event and global warming because, of course, weather fluctuates all the time. What's significant about this new finding by the World Meteorological Organization?
Well, I'm not sure that I think we are careful, and I think possibly the World Meteorological Organization ought to be also. It is really very hard to say that anything's a certain result of global warming. What you do have, though, is two events close by each other, which are, in fact, causally linked, but not in a way that reflects global warming. That's the heat wave in Russia and the floods in Pakistan, which are both due to some slightly odd behavior of the jet stream, not entirely due, but both linked by that. And those are both the sorts of events which climate scientists have been saying will become more frequent under a regime of global warming.
What about the flooding and landslides in China and the very peculiar weather we've had here in the United States? Is there any relationship between them or between them and the other two events you just described?
The flooding in China, possibly. I don't think there's any evidence to think that the weather in the United States is linked to this particular system of so-called blocking highs that's stretched out over Europe and then into Asia. It's worth remembering that the world being a large place, there are always extreme weather events of some sort going on somewhere. I don't think that's an entire explanation as to why we see a lot of extreme weather at the moment, but it's certainly something that one has to bear in mind, especially when thinking about individual events.
Does it appear that the timing of the release of this report has something to do with the weather and that there's an effort to affect the political debate about this issue?
I have no idea whether that's what the WMO is trying to do. It doesn't seem to me that the evidence is that individual events like this do, in fact, greatly influence the political situation. You might make an argument that the summer of 1988 did, but I don't think in general extreme events, though they develop, they bring a lot of media coverage with them, I'm not sure that they actually move the politics very much. The politics is, in fact, it seems to me, fairly settled in these issues.
Oliver Morton, Energy and Environmental Editor for The Economist magazine. Michael Hanlon is Science Editor at The Daily Mail and author of Eternity, Our Next Billion Years. Michael Hanlon, good to have you on our program.
Hi.
You've been a global warming skeptic. You've also gone to the Arctic to investigate what's going on up there. Has that changed your views?
A little bit. I used to be what I always termed a rather soft skeptic, and now I'm a rather reluctant believer, I suppose. I think the problem is when we're looking at extreme weather events, as everyone will say, is that it's very, very difficult to say whether a hot summer in Moscow or a cold winter in the UK or a floods in Pakistan are because of global warming. All we've got are statistics. We can say how likely are these events and with what frequency are they likely to occur. And I think the big problem that the consensus, the global warming community, for want of a better term, has, is persuading the public that global warming is happening now. I think the issue here is that global warming is something that we will see develop over decades. And it's very hard to keep the public interested if you say, well, we expect to see heat waves like this in Russia once every 15 years rather than once every 25 years. I mean, that would be climate change if that was happening. But people's, it's very hard to get the public's attention span to be longer than 3 months, let alone 3 years or 15 years. So everyone's playing a game here. And I think it's very, very hard to tease out the truth from the games being played. And I think part of the problem that we've seen in the last year with the unraveling of the climate summit in Copenhagen in Denmark, with the leaking of the emails from the climate research unit in University of East Anglia here in the UK, and the growth of scepticism and growth of public apathy, is that there's been a realization that climate change is not a wholly scientific issue. It is a social, economic, and political issue as well. And my fear is that some of the scientists have done a pact with the devil almost. They've decided to take that on board. They've presented what are, in fact, social and sociological questions as scientific questions. And when this kind of uncertainty is exposed, people throw their hands up and say the whole thing is a conspiracy and a con. And I think if you do go somewhere like the Arctic, you can see things are changing. You speak to people up there, and by no means all the scientists working up on the ice cap are die-hard global warming scaremongers. I mean, one of the guys I was speaking to up there said he'd been pretty skeptical about the Greenlandic ice cap melting, and he said after 4 years working up there, he is now far less skeptical. But talk of Greenland melting in 100 years or 50 years is nonsense. Talk of sea levels rising by 10 meters in the next 50 years, as I've read in papers, is nonsense. But I think it's now very hard to deny that something's going on. It's also, we have to be careful. We have to trust the public with facts rather than exaggeration.
Again, Michael Hanlon, a science editor at the Daily Mail, author of Eternity, Our Next Billion Years. Anthony Lysarowitz is director of the Project on Climate Change Communication at Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He's author of the report Global Warming's Six Americas. Professor, what do you mean by Six Americas? First of all, welcome to our program. Secondly, what about Six Americas?
Yes, thank you, Warren. It's great to be here with you. So what we do is we study American public opinion on climate change. What do they understand, misunderstand about climate change? How do they perceive the risks? What policies do they support or oppose? What kinds of behaviors are people engaged in? And one of the interesting things that we found is that the American public doesn't speak with a single voice on this issue, or pretty much any other issue for that matter. And what we found is that there are six distinct groups or audiences within the United States that each respond to this issue in very different ways. So what we found is that one group we call the alarmed. These are people who are absolutely convinced it's happening, human-caused, a very serious and urgent problem, taking action in their own lives, want to know what's the next thing that we can do. Then comes a group we call the concerned, believe it's happening, believe it's human-caused, but it seems as distant, somewhere that's going to happen maybe a generation away. So while they want something done about it, it's not urgent. Then come a group that we call the cautious, not really sure if it's happening or not, human-caused or not. A group we call the disengaged, who have heard the term but know nothing about it. For them, really, it's about complete lack of awareness. Then come two groups that are very interesting that we call the doubtful. Don't really think it's happening, but if it is, it's natural and nothing to worry about. And then last but not least is a group that we call the dismissive, who are convinced not only that it's not happening, but many of them believe that it's a conspiracy. So each of these groups listens to this debate and draws on these new experiences or new scientific findings or these extreme weather events and tends to interpret them from their own perspective.
What does that mean in terms of any effort that might be launched, cap and trade, carbon tax, whatever, and its chances of getting enough support in the United States to actually pass the Congress?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's been very interesting is that as this issue has moved from a debate over the science, and the science, at least within the scientific community, is mostly settled about the fact that it's happening and human-caused and of serious concern. But as that discussion has moved into, okay, so now what do we do about it? that inevitably brings it into the field, as I think your prior guest said, of social, political, and economic issues. And people, of course, respond to those based on their deeply held political and economic values. And that's certainly one of the things that we see here, is that you've seen this real, on the one hand, set of actors within society who take this on and say, this is a critical issue, we must deal with it. And on the other side, you have another set of actors who say, you know, actually, we don't believe the problem, but what we really are afraid of is the potential solutions.
Gavin Schmidt is a climate scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia University. Gavin Schmidt, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Michael Hanlon said a moment ago that many scientists have, as he put it, made a pact with the devil and aren't acknowledging uncertainties, and that gives them a problem with the general public when those things are exposed. How do you respond to that?
Well, apart from that, I agreed with everything that Michael had to say. I mean, he's absolutely right about how we need to distinguish between what's scientifically known and what the solution to that scientific problem is. You know, I don't think that any scientists actually have made pacts with the devil. But what happens when scientists get quoted in public or that things become headlines is that everything gets condensed down, and all of the caveats and things that scientists spend all of their time working on that fill the scientific literature, that gets condensed to a press release, that gets condensed to a story, and that gets condensed to a headline, and the headlines combined with, you know, the media's you guys like a little bit of controversy, you like a little bit of sensation. Those two things add up with the condensation of all the scientific knowledge into things which can sometimes be misleading. And I think sometimes people look at the headlines and think that's what scientists are going around talking about. But if you actually go to conferences, you talk to the scientists, you look at what they're actually writing when they're not being quoted or misconstrued, then you don't find any of this what he would perceive as alarmism. There's alarm, but I think it's justified alarm. But the idea that scientists are running around like Chicken Little is, I think, a bit of a myth.
Gavin Schmidt again at NASA and Columbia University. Myron Bell is Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That's a research center advancing free enterprise and limited government. He is a well-known skeptic of global warming. Myron Bell, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Are you speaking to people primarily who are fearful of solutions, as we heard Anthony Lazarowicz say a certain portion of Americans are? And do you do that at the Competitive Enterprise Institute on behalf of the energy industry and others that will have to bear the costs, at least from a business standpoint, if a lot of steps are taken to try to deal with this issue?
Warren, a lot of the energy industry, including most of the big oil companies and most of the electric utilities, have come out in favor of reducing emissions through cap and trade, and we are opposed to that. I think what we try to do...
Aren't a lot of them backing away now that it appears to be dead in the water?
Well, of course, everybody backs away from things when they're dead, and cap and trade is dying, so I expect that they will decide. But, you know, they've decided that they can make money from really essentially a huge wealth transfer from consumers to them as energy prices go up. And the thing that makes this debate unreal is that we have a lot of people who pontificate about what ought to be done to reduce emissions who have no clue as to what it might actually cost people. And, of course, if you do a very simple cost-benefit analysis, you'll find out that the costs of trying to address global warming, particularly for poor people in poor countries like India and China, are a lot greater than any potential benefits from reducing emissions. And I don't mean two or three times. I mean 10 or 20 or 30 times more expensive. And so, of course, people in China are interested in building two coal-fired power plants a week and getting electricity to rural areas. Of course, people in India want to become wealthy enough so that they can handle natural disasters. And so I think that there's a lot of the scientific community in pushing global warming alarmism is responsible for an awful lot of misunderstanding and incomprehension of really what they're pushing.
Let me go back to Michael Hanlon with the Daily Mail, author of Eternity, Our Next Billion Years. You went up to the Arctic. You said to some extent that changed your mind. You became a reluctant supporter of global warming. Are you concerned that concerns of that sort about the costs, for example, are risky?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, first off, I mean, I don't think we're going to do anything about climate change. If in my earlier incarnation as a skeptic, I was wrong, and I now think I may be right to be concerned, I have to be very concerned. I don't think the world is going to do anything. Carbon emissions continue to rise. I don't think the world is going to do anything to stop this. I think the kind of action that the people are advocating, whole tens of percents of reductions in CO2 emissions, simply are not going to happen this century. It's just inconceivable this will happen. And I think what we're going to have to do is learn to live with climate change. I think we're going to have to learn to live in a warmer world, if that's what we're looking forward to. We're going to have to adapt. We've adapted before to changes in climate.
Let me go back to Anthony Lazarowicz at Yale. Does that pretty much confirm what you have found and the six audiences that you have discovered in the United States? Cumulatively, would you say that it's very unlikely that anything's going to be done?
Oh, I think we don't know the answer to that at all. Politics is you know, a highly. You think climate science is perhaps unpredictable. I mean, politics is even more so. So, you know, I certainly would take issue with the statement made by your prior speaker that most people don't care about the future. We actually find that people do care quite a bit about the future. Yes, it's true, they discount that going forward, but we're also not talking about necessarily people who aren't going to be born until the 22nd century.
Well, they say they care about the future, but are they willing to pay to make the future more comfortable?
Yes, they are. Now, they're not willing to, you know, bankrupt themselves to do so, but they're certainly willing to pay the kind of prices that most, and see, this gets back to the other comment that was made, of what are the economic costs. So, and again, here's where the debate has shifted. It used to be about climate science. Now the debate has shifted increasingly to what are the economic costs. And so we've just heard from the Competitive Enterprise Institute that this is going to bankrupt the economy, which is what their typical line is. But in fact, with all deference to our friends who are economists, most of the economic studies show that that's simply not the case. Yes, there will be costs, but they are not going to bankrupt the economy.
Let me go back to Gavin Schmidt, the last opportunity we have to ask a question before our program ends. Gavin Schmidt, what would be the consequences of what Michael Hanlon predicts, not doing anything?
I don't know for certain, and that's what scares me. He went to Greenland. We know that Greenland is losing mass. Right now it's at a relatively slow rate, but it is losing mass. And that's with the temperatures that we have now. As the planet continues to warm, and we haven't got to the, we haven't even caught up with what we've done to the planet so far, and yet we keep on doing more. We don't know how much of Greenland will melt, and we don't know at what rate it will melt, and that directly impacts sea level rise. And you know, a slow rate of sea level rise, yeah, you know, we can lose a few beach houses here and there, a little bit more erosion, but a foot, 2 foot, 3 foot. You know,
those are numbers that
are really extremely alarming for cities and the hundreds of millions of people that live on the coast.
All right. I'm sorry. We're out of time. I beg your pardon for interrupting you. Gavin Schmidt, a climate scientist at NASA Goddard Institute and Columbia University. Thanks very much to you. Thanks to Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Anthony Lazarowicz at Yale, Michael Hanlon at the Daily Mail, his book Eternity, Our Next Billion Years, and Oliver Morton, energy and environmental editor for The Economist magazine.